Trend number one, China faces tough choices. Since it entered the WTO in 2001, China has successfully exploited the opportunities provided by that system without adhering to its rules. This has led to explosive growth in Chinese exports, while U.S. manufacturing employment fell precipitously. What the U.S. needs is the ability to sell what the U.S. specializes in, which are high-end goods and services in China's rapidly growing market without facing informal tariffs or fearing loss of sensitive intellectual property to emerging Chinese competitors that have unlimited access to state lending. That means playing by the common set of rules China agreed to when it joined the World Trade Organization and abiding by WTO rulings to resolve complaints, just as the U.S. and its other trading partners do when disputes inevitably arise. Actions in the short term appear to be aimed at addressing the superficial concerns of both sides and winning domestic political points. For instance, China will buy a very substantial amount of U.S. agriculture, energy, and industrial goods, with purchases of farm products beginning immediately. Ad hoc, state-directed purchases of U.S. goods by China might dent the bilateral deficit, but it won't address the underlying structural issues. A larger impact will come from cuts in formal tariffs. For instance, China, home to the world's largest auto market, will remove existing 40% tariffs on U.S. auto imports. Going forward, the argument will focus on Beijing's promise to curb practices such as forced technology transfers, non-enforcement of intellectual property protections, and cyber theft. In exchange, the U.S. will reduce today's 10% tariffs targeting $200 billion in Chinese imports rather than raising them to 25%. Unfortunately, there appears to be little evidence that China actually intends to abandon the mercantilist strategy that it has had in place since at least 2006. As Philip Orchard recently explained in Geopolitical Futures, Beijing thought it could buy its way out of the trade war by dramatically ramping up purchases of high-dollar U.S. goods it needed anyway, such as oil and gas, and by implementing modest reforms on market access and foreign investment. China would happily buy however much stuff it would take to allow Trump to claim victory on the deficit. Doing so would certainly be cheaper and easier than trying to bail out all the Chinese exporters that were about to get slammed by the U.S. tariffs at an economically inopportune time. Reinforcing Beijing's strategy was the correct belief that tariffs would take a financial toll on the U.S. too. They would hurt U.S. consumers whose living standards had improved thanks to cheap Chinese goods, U.S.-based firms dependent on inputs made in China, and U.S.-owned exporters with factories in China. Beijing assumed that with midterm elections around the corner, Trump would have little appetite for a mutually destructive trade war that would rattle markets and put the White House at odds with constituencies such as farmers and free traders that traditionally vote Republican. And this, Beijing hoped, would discourage the U.S. from pushing for structural overhauls in Chinese trade practices. However, Beijing's strategy fell short. Despite the fourth quarter stock market dip, the U.S. economy is humming along at near the peak of the business cycle. The trade war has definitely hurt some U.S. sectors, and there will be long-term costs to the U.S. economy if it loses access to China's gigantic consumer market, especially if other high-value exporting countries in Europe and Asia don't face the same barriers. But the pain has been subtle enough and trade policy esoteric enough to prevent the trade war from becoming a major political issue. In fact, the congressional districts in which trade influenced voters' decisions tended to be those that have benefited from new tariffs, particularly on steel and aluminum. More problematic for Beijing is a bipartisan recognition in the U.S. that China has stopped making progress on its WTO commitments, and that the onus is on the U.S. to stop China from enjoying the benefits of the global trade system without abiding by its rules. There's also a growing consensus that Chinese practices such as forced technology transfers, outright technology theft, and its overt, state-backed Made in China 2025 plan to dominate high-tech industries are indeed a threat to U.S. interest and the rules-based order, even if there's a disagreement over whether punitive tariffs are an effective way to address them. Add to this widespread suspicions surrounding China's broader geopolitical ambitions. For those who think Washington and Beijing are sliding inexorably toward a new Cold War, anything that weakens China is worthwhile. There is no compromise. China, for its part, can't make the sweeping changes Washington demands without giving up the tools it thinks it needs to solve its own political and economic problems. And most importantly, Beijing thinks these problems far outweigh those created by losing access to the U.S. market. Consider the facts. Beijing needs to be able to tightly control the yuan, intervene on behalf of domestic firms, and use the tools of the state to export excess industrial capacity. That's the impetus for the Belt and Road Initiative, or BRI. Large state-owned firms are needed to soak up excess labor. To deal with rising wages, slowing growth, and an unenviable demographic outlook, China must now make a mad dash up the manufacturing value chain into high-tech sectors. Why? Because during the decades when high-tech exporters like Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and Germany were moving to the technological and industrial vanguard, China was an isolated backwater. It's playing from behind, and the government is willing to do whatever it takes to skip to the front of the line. That's why China is forcing foreign firms who want to operate in China to form joint ventures with local firms to maximize technology transfer, supporting commercial espionage, and overtly shoveling money into state-owned firms in industries deemed strategic. The U.S. just doesn't have the leverage to change China's priorities. The cost of U.S. tariffs is likely to be, at most, around 2-3% of GDP. Meanwhile, the cost of failing to keep people employed, moving into high-end exports, and spurring sustainable long-term growth may well be the end of the Communist Party of China. In response to this reality, Orchard argues that both the U.S. and China are beginning to dramatically rewire their respective economies. The U.S. will stop indirectly helping China, either by creating incentives for multinational firms to reroute supply chains around China, or by encouraging U.S. exporters to tailor their products to other markets, or both. Most of what the U.S. buys from China is made by multinational firms, which will become more willing to take on the costs of relocating if it becomes clear that tariffs are here to stay. To expedite this process and bolster a rules-based global trading system, the U.S. will eventually once again embrace the benefits of multilateral trade blocs such as the TPP. Orchard goes on to observe that China will have little choice but to shift focus to preserving market access in Europe and other wealthy states. It will also crack down on any social fallout from the intense but ultimately temporary disruption that follows, while hoping that increased domestic consumption will ease the pain. The truth is, China's dependence on the U.S. market was shrinking before the trade war even began. And rather than force Beijing to rethink its trade policies, that war has convinced the government that it must reduce its dependence on foreign markets and technology. With enough partners outside the U.S. and with enough money to throw at the challenge, it may actually succeed. However, this does not fully recognize the precarious reality facing Xi as he plays the world's highest-stakes game with the unpredictable Trump. On December 16, 2018, Professor Jiang Songzhou of Renmin University School of Finance and former chief economist of China Agriculture Bank gave a powerful presentation to a gathering of Chinese executives. Jiang asked, "How bad are things?" The number that China's National Bureau of Statistics, or NBS, gives is 6.5% growth. But just yesterday, a research group of an important institution released an internal report. They used two measurements. Going by the first estimate, China's GDP growth this year was about 1.67%. And according to the other calculation, the growth rate was negative. He then went on to address the enormous challenge facing China's financial sector. Local debt is a big problem in China's financial market. As for the actual number, the National Audit Office claims it to be about 17.8 trillion renminbi, while He Kang, vice director of National People's Congress Financial and Economic Affairs Committee, thinks it's over 40 trillion renminbi, or roughly $590 billion. Worse yet, not one local government intends to pay back its debts. Then, there's also the stock market crash. An impending stock market rebound is possible, but in my opinion, it's far from forthcoming. You can look at the history. Only the Wall Street crash of 1929 can compare to the steep decline that the Chinese stock market has experienced this year. Many stocks are down 80 or even 90%. We know China's stock market is feeling the pain, but what exactly is hurting? Look at our profit structure. To put it plainly, China's listed companies don't really make money. Then, who has taken the few profits made by China's more than 3,000 listed companies? Two-thirds have been taken by the banking sector and real estate. When we buy stocks, we are buying the profits of the company, not hype and rumors. I recently read a report comparing the profits of China's listed companies with those in the U.S. There are many U.S. public companies with tens of billions of dollars in profits. How many Chinese tech and manufacturing companies are there that have accomplished this? There's only one, Huawei, but it's not listed. What does this tell us? As Yale professor Robert Shiller said, stock market performance may not work as a barometer of the economy in the short run, but it does for sure in the long run. Terrible stock performance only demonstrates one thing, which is that the real economy in China is in quite a mess. Jiang's bottom line, Trump could hardly have picked a better time strategically to launch his trade offensive. Given this trend, we offer the following forecasts for your consideration. First, the end result of the current trade war will be a more even playing field, but it will not be the end of the struggle. China lacks the staying power needed to overtly maintain its unfair trade practices. Therefore, it will negotiate a set of adjustments that are both face-saving and minimally disruptive. As a result, the bilateral Sino-American trade deficit will nearly disappear, and foreign multinationals will gain greater but still limited access to Chinese consumer markets. Meanwhile, Chinese promises to protect intellectual property, abandon coerced technology transfers, and curb industrial espionage will only be honored to the extent that the United States works with the EU, Korea, Japan, and others to identify and punish violations. Second, despite diverging geopolitical and economic interests, the United States and China will not fall back into a Cold War relationship. If the U.S. cannot compel China to change, it will eventually lose interest in futile measures that cut off trade in areas where trade is mutually beneficial. For instance, cheap Chinese electronics are not a national security threat, and the Chinese consumer market will remain nearly irresistible to U.S. exporters, especially in segments where the U.S. is the low-cost producer. It's easy to see the two countries settling on a limited but largely healthy trade relationship in the future, even if the thornier points of contention never go away. How we get to that point comes down to the broader geopolitical competition between the U.S. and China. Third, by 2024, many of the biggest multinational exporters in China will simply decide they want no part of this Sino-American battle and simply go to some other low-cost manufacturing hub. According to a Peterson Institute for International Economic Study, the first two rounds of U.S. tariffs disproportionately affected U.S. imports from China-based affiliates of multinational firms rather than Chinese-owned firms. Already, more than 70% of U.S. firms with operations in China surveyed say they are mulling whether to delay or cancel new investments in China or leaving for greener, cheaper pastures altogether. Where will they go? India perhaps comes closest to matching China's competitive advantages. Last year, India's labor force clocked in at a hefty 520 million people. And because of extreme class disparities, it can meet the labor cost needs of firms up and down the value chain. It's particularly competitive in the garment industry, thanks in part to robust local cotton production. On the other hand, India's strengths still lie mainly in services and low-end manufacturing, because it still lacks the infrastructure needed for high-end manufacturing. Due to factors like the convoluted regulatory environment, in 2017, India ranked just 77th on the World Bank's Ease of Doing Business Index. That's a jump of 23 spots over 2016, but it's still well behind rankings of 46th for China, 27th for Thailand, and 15th for Malaysia. So despite India's draws, only 6.5% of U.S. firms in China surveyed in a September 2018 report by the American Chamber of Commerce said they were considering relocating to India, compared to 18.5% for Southeast Asia. And fourth, while China's Belt and Road Initiative will make it less vulnerable to U.S. pressure over the next decade, it will also politically isolate it from its neighbors. BRI is designed to ensure open trade routes and alliances across Asia and even Europe. Some BRI investments could also create potential military advantages for China, should China require access to selected foreign ports to pre-position the necessary logistics support to sustain naval deployments in waters as distant as the Indian Ocean, Mediterranean Sea, and Atlantic Ocean to protect its growing interests. Still, Chinese predatory lending, bribery, reliance on Chinese labor, and so forth are probably making Beijing's political problems, particularly with these countries, vexing. And anti-ethnic Chinese sentiments in a number of BRI states will further complicate things. A good example is the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, where China and Pakistan relations are by no means smooth sailing. The new government in Islamabad is seeking to renegotiate the terms of the project. More importantly, the problem for China is that it's encroaching on other powers' traditional spheres of influence, and it's not yet powerful enough to do so without spurring rival states into action. For example, India won't let China use BRI to tie Sri Lanka, the Maldives, and Bangladesh without a fight. Similarly, Australia won't permit China to control island nations across the South Pacific. And Japan is strengthening ties with the Philippines, Thailand, Malaysia, and Sri Lanka.